tree. Messersmith waited for an appropriate moment to take Goering aside. I told him, in very few words, that a person in whom I had absolute confidence had called on me that morning and told me that Himmler was bent on getting rid of Diels during the course of the day, and that Diels was actually to be bumped off. Goering thanked him for the information. The two rejoined the other guests, but a few moments later Goering offered his regrets and left. What happened next, what threats were made, what compromises struck, whether Hitler himself intervened isn't clear, but by 5 o'clock that afternoon, April 1st, 1934, Messersmith learned that Diels had been named Regierungspräsident, or Regional Commissioner of Cologne, and that the Gestapo would now be headed by Himmler. Diels was saved, but Goering had suffered a significant defeat. He had acted not for the sake of past friendship, but out of anger at the prospect of Himmler trying to arrest Diels in his own realm. Himmler, however, had won the greatest prize, the last and most important component of his secret police empire. It was, Messersmith wrote, the first setback that Goering had had since the beginning of the Nazi regime. A photograph of the moment when Himmler officially took control of the Gestapo at a ceremony on April 20, 1934, shows Himmler speaking at the podium, his aspect bland as ever, as Diels stands nearby facing the camera. His face seems swollen as if from excess drink or lack of sleep, and his scars are exceptionally pronounced. He is the portrait of a man under duress. In a conversation with a British embassy official that occurred at about this time, quoted in a memorandum later filed with the Foreign Office in London, Diels delivered a monologue on his own moral unease. The infliction of physical punishment is not every man's job, and naturally we were only too glad to recruit men who were prepared to show no squeamishness at their task. Unfortunately, we knew nothing about the Freudian side of the business, and it was only after a number of instances of unnecessary flogging and meaningless cruelty that I tumbled to the fact that my organization had been attracting all the sadists in Germany and Austria without my knowledge for some time past. It had also been attracting unconscious sadists, i.e. men who did not know themselves that they had sadist leanings until they took part in a flogging. And finally, it had been actually creating sadists. For it seems that corporal chastisement ultimately arouses sadistic leanings in apparently normal men and women. Freud might explain it. April brought strangely little rain, but a bumper crop of fresh secrets. Early in the month, Hitler and Defense Minister Blumberg learned that President Hindenburg had become ill, gravely so, and was unlikely to survive the summer. They kept the news to themselves. Hitler coveted the presidential authority still possessed by Hindenburg, and planned upon his death to combine in himself the roles of Chancellor and President, and thereby at last acquire absolute power. But two potential barriers remained, the Reichswehr and Rome's stormtroopers. In mid-April, Hitler flew to the naval port of Kiel, and there boarded a pocket battleship, the Deutschland, for a 4-day voyage, accompanied by Blumberg, Admiral Erich Raeder, head of the Navy, and General Werner von Fritsch, chief of the Army Command. Details are scarce, but apparently in their intimate quarters of the ship, Hitler and Blumberg crafted a secret deal, truly a devil's bargain, in which Hitler would neutralize Rome and the SA in return for the army's support for his acquisition of presidential authority upon Hindenburg's death. The deal was of incalculable value to Hitler, for now he could go forward without having to worry about where the army stood. Rome, meanwhile, became increasingly insistent on winning control over the nation's armed forces. In April, during one of his morning rides in the Tiergarten, he watched a group of senior Nazis pass by, then turned to a companion. "Look at those people over there," he said. "The party isn't a political force anymore. It's turning into an old age home. People like that. We've got to get rid of them quickly." He grew bolder about airing his displeasure. At a press conference on April 18th, he said, "Reactionaries, bourgeois conformists, we feel like vomiting when we think of them." He declared, "The SA is the National Socialist Revolution." 2 days later, however, a government announcement seemed to undercut Rome's declarations of self-importance. The entire SA had been ordered to go on leave for the month of July. On April 22nd, Heinrich Himmler appointed his young protege, Reinhard Heydrich, newly 30, to fill Diels's job as chief of the Gestapo. Heydrich was blonde, tall, slim, and considered handsome, save for a head described as disproportionately narrow and eyes spaced too closely. He spoke in a near falsetto that was perversely out of step with his reputation for being coolly and utterly ruthless. Hitler dubbed him the man with the iron heart, and yet Heydrich was said to play the violin with such passion that he would weep as he executed certain passages. Throughout his career he would battle rumors that he was in fact Jewish, despite an investigation by the Nazi Party that purported to find no truth to the allegation. With Diels gone, the last trace of civility left the Gestapo. Hans Gisidius, the Gestapo memoirist, recognized at once that under Himmler and Heydrich, the organization would undergo a change of character. "I could very well venture combat with Diels, the unsteady playboy, who, conscious of being a bourgeois renegade, had a good many inhibitions holding him back from foul play," Gisidius wrote. "But as soon as Himmler and Heydrich entered the arena, I should have prudently withdrawn." Toward the end of April, the government at last revealed to the public the grave state of Hindenburg's health. Suddenly the question of who would succeed him became a matter of pressing conversation everywhere. All who were aware of the deepening split between Rome and Hitler understood that a new element of suspense now propelled the narrative. Chapter 37 Watchers. While all this was occurring, another nation's spies became interested in the Dodds. By April, Martha's relationship with Boris had caught the interest of his superiors in the NKVD. They sensed a rare opportunity. "Tell Boris Vinogradov that we want to use him to carry out a project that interests us," one wrote in a message to the agency's Berlin chief. Somehow, possibly through Boris, Moscow had come to understand that Martha's infatuation with the Nazi revolution was beginning to wane. The message continued. "It has to do with the fact that, according to our information, the sentiments of his acquaintance, Martha Dodd, have fully ripened for her to be recruited, once and for all, to work for us." Chapter 38 Humbugged. What most troubled Dodd during his leave was his sense that his opponents in the State Department were growing more aggressive. He became concerned about what he saw as a pattern of disclosures of confidential information that seemed aimed at undermining his standing. A troubling incident occurred on the night of Saturday, April 14th, as he was leaving the annual Gridiron Club dinner in Washington. A young State Department officer whom he did not know approached him and began a conversation in which he openly challenged Dodd's appraisal of conditions in Germany, citing a confidential dispatch the ambassador had cabled from Berlin. The young man was much taller than Dodd and stood very close, in a manner Dodd found physically intimidating. In an angry letter that Dodd planned to hand in person to Secretary Hull, he described the encounter as an intentional affront. Most distressing to Dodd, however, was the question of how the young man had gotten access to his dispatch. "It is my opinion," Dodd wrote, "that there is a group somewhere in the department who think of themselves and not the country, and who, upon the slightest effort of any ambassador or minister to economize and improve, begin consorting together to discredit and defeat him. This is the third or fourth time entirely confidential information I have given has been treated as gossip, or made gossip. I am not in the service for any personal or social gain and or status. I am ready to do anything possible for better work and cooperation, but I do not wish to work alone, or become the object of constant intrigue and maneuver. I shall not resign, however, in silence if this sort of thing continues." Dodd decided not to give the letter to Hull after all. It ended up filed among papers he identified as undelivered. What Dodd apparently did not yet know was that he and 15 other ambassadors had been the subject of a major article in the April 1934 issue of Fortune magazine. Despite the article's prominence and the fact that it must surely have been a topic of rabid conversation within the State Department, Dodd only learned of its existence much later, after his return to Berlin, when Martha brought home a copy she had received during an appointment with her Berlin dentist. Entitled, "Their Excellencies, Our Ambassadors," the article identified the appointees and indicated their personal wealth by placing dollar signs next to their names. Jesse Isidore Strauss, ambassador to France and former president of R.H. Macy & Company, was identified as a $4 sign Strauss. Dodd had a single cent next to his name. The article poked fun at his cheapskate approach to diplomacy and suggested that in renting his Berlin house at a discount from a Jewish banker, he was seeking to profit from the plight of Germany's Jews. So, the article stated, the Dodds got a nice little house very cheap and managed to run it with only a few servants. The article noted that Dodd had brought his weary old Chevrolet to Berlin. His son was supposed to run it for him evenings, the writer said, but the son wanted to go the places and do the things sons have a habit of doing, and that left Mr. Dodd chauffeurless, though top-hatted, in his Chevrolet. Dodd, the article claimed, was left having to cadge rides from junior embassy officers, the luckier of them in their chauffeured limousines. The writer called Dodd a square academic peg in a round diplomatic hole, who was hampered by his relative poverty and lack of diplomatic aplomb. Morally a very courageous person, he is so intellectual, so divorced from run-of-mind human beings, that he talks in parables, as one gentleman and scholar to another, and the brown-shirted brethren of blood and steel can't understand him even when they care to. So Dodd boils inwardly, and when he tries to get tough, nobody pays much attention. It was immediately clear to Dodd that one or more officials within the State Department, and perhaps even his office in Berlin, had revealed fine-grained details of his life in Germany. Dodd complained to Undersecretary Phillips. The article, he wrote, reveals a strange and even unpatriotic attitude, so far as my record and efforts here are concerned. In my letter of acceptance, I said to the President that it must be understood I was to live on my salary income. How and why so much discussion of this simple and obvious fact for me? He cited diplomats from history who had lived modestly. Why all this condemnation of my following such examples? He told Phillips that he suspected people within his own embassy were leaking information and cited other news accounts that had carried distorted reports. How all these false stories and no reference to real services I have attempted to render. Phillips waited nearly a month to respond. With regard to that article in Fortune, he wrote, I would not give it another thought. I cannot imagine where the information to which you refer came from any more than I can imagine how the press gets hold of gossip, usually erroneous, in regard to myself and other colleagues of yours. He urged Dodd, don't let this particular item disturb you in the least. Dodd did get to spend a little time in the Library of Congress doing research for his Old South, and managed to carve out 2 weeks on his farm, where he wrote and tended farm matters, and he was able to travel to Chicago as planned, but this did not yield the pleasant re-encounter he had anticipated. Once there, he wrote to Martha, everybody wanted to see me. Telephones, letters, visits, luncheons, dinners, all the time. He fielded many inquiries about her and her brother, he wrote. But only one about your problem in New York, meaning her divorce. A friend wanted to show him examples of how decently Chicago papers treated it, but he wrote, "I did not care to read clippings." He gave speeches and resolved faculty squabbles. In his diary, he noted that he also met with two Jewish leaders whom he had contacted previously in fulfilling Roosevelt's directive to damp Jewish protest. The two men described how they and their friends had calmed their fellows and prevented any violent demonstrations in Chicago as planned. A personal crisis intruded. While in Chicago, Dodd received a telegram relaying a message from his wife. After enduring the inevitable spasm of anxiety that telegrams from loved ones sparked, Dodd read that his old Chevy, icon of his ambassadorship, had been totaled by his chauffeur. The kicker, "Therefore hope you can bring new car." So now Dodd, while on his supposedly restorative leave, was being asked in the matter-of-fact language of telegraphy to buy a new car and arrange for its shipping to Berlin. He wrote to Martha later, "I fear Mueller was driving carelessly, as I noted several times before I came away. Dodd could not understand it. He himself had driven between his farm and Washington, D.C. many times, and had driven all over the city without ever having an accident. While this may prove nothing, it suggests something. People who do not own the car are far less careful than those who do. In light of what was to happen a few years hence, Dodd's crowing about his own driving prowess can only raise a chill. He wanted a Buick, but deemed the price, $1,350, too much to spend, given the limited time his family expected to stay in Berlin. He also worried about the $100 he would have to pay to ship the car to Germany. Ultimately, he got his Buick. He instructed his wife to buy it from a dealer in Berlin. The car, he wrote, was a basic model that his embassy protocol experts disparaged as ridiculously simple for an ambassador. Dodd was able to make one more visit to his farm, which cheered him, but also made his final departure all the more painful. "This was a beautiful day," he wrote in his diary on Sunday, May 6, 1934. "The budding trees and the apple blooms were most appealing, especially since I must leave." 3 days later, Dodd's ship sailed from New York. He felt he had achieved a victory in getting Jewish leaders to agree to ease the intensity of their protests against Germany, and hoped his efforts would bring further moderation on the part of Hitler's government. These hopes were chilled, however, when on Saturday, May 12th, while in mid-ocean, he got word via wireless of a speech just delivered by Goebbels, in which the propaganda minister called Jews the syphilis of all European peoples. Dodd felt betrayed. Despite Nazi promises about arrest warrants and closure of the Columbia House prison, clearly nothing had changed. He feared that now he appeared naive. He wrote to Roosevelt of his dismay after all the work he had done with American Jewish leaders. Goebbels' speech had rekindled all the animosities of the preceding winter, he wrote, and I was put in the position of having been humbugged, as indeed I was. He reached Berlin on Thursday, May 17th at 10:30 p.m., and found a changed city. During his 2 months away, drought had browned the landscape to a degree he had never seen before. But there was something else. "I was delighted to be home," he wrote, "but the tense atmosphere was revealed at once." Part 6. Berlin at Dusk. Chapter 39. Dangerous Dining. The city seemed to vibrate with a background thrum of danger, as if an immense power line had been laid through its center. Everyone in Dodd's circle felt it. Partly this tension arose from the unusual May weather and the concomitant fears of a failed harvest. But the main engine of anxiety was the intensifying discord between Captain Rome's stormtroopers and the regular army. A popular metaphor used at the time to describe the atmosphere in Berlin was that of an approaching thunderstorm, that sense of charged and suspended air. Dodd had little chance to settle back into the rhythms of work. The day after his return from America, he faced the prospect of hosting a giant goodbye banquet for Messersmith, who had at last managed to secure for himself a loftier post, though not in Prague, his original target. Competition for that job had been robust, and although Messersmith had lobbied hard and persuaded allies of all stripes to write letters to bolster his bid, in the end the job went to someone else. Instead, Undersecretary Phillips had offered Messersmith another vacant post, Uruguay. If Messersmith had been disappointed, he had not shown it. He had counted himself lucky simply to be leaving the consular service behind. But then his luck had gotten better still. The post of ambassador to Austria suddenly had become vacant, and Messersmith was the obvious choice for the job. Roosevelt agreed. Now Messersmith truly was delighted. So too was Dodd, just to have him gone, though he'd have preferred to have him at the other side of the world. There were many parties for Messersmith. For a time, every dinner and luncheon in Berlin seemed to be in his honor, but the U.S. Embassy's banquet on May 18th was the biggest and most official. While Dodd was in America, Mrs. Dodd, with the assistance of embassy protocol experts, had overseen the creation of a 4-page, single-spaced list of guests that seemed to include everyone of import except Hitler. To anyone knowledgeable about Berlin society, the real fascination was not who attended, but who did not. Goering and Goebbels sent their regrets, as did Vice-Chancellor Papen and Rudolf Diels. Defense Minister Blumberg came, but not SA Chief Röhm. Bella Fromm attended, and so did Sigrid Schultz and various of Martha's friends, including Putzi Hanfstengel, Armand Berard, and Prince Louis Ferdinand. This mixture by itself added to the aura of tension in the room, for Berard still loved Martha, and Prince Louis mooned for her, though her adoration remained utterly fixed on Boris, absent, interestingly, from the invitation list. Martha's handsome young Hitler liaison, Hans Tommy Thompson, came, as did his oft-times companion, the dark and lushly beautiful Elmina Rangebe. But there was a hitch this night. Tommy brought his wife. There was heat, champagne, passion, jealousy, and that background sense of something unpleasant building just over the horizon. Bella Fromm chatted briefly with Hanfstengel and recorded the encounter in her diary. "I wonder why we were asked today," Hanfstengel said. "All this excitement about Jews. Messersmith is one. So is Roosevelt. The party detests them." "Dr. Hanfstengel," Fromm said, "we've discussed this before. You don't have to put on that kind of an act with me." "All right. Even if they are Aryan, you'd never know it from their actions." At the moment, Fromm was not feeling particularly solicitous of Nazi goodwill. 2 weeks earlier, her daughter, Goni, had left for America with Messersmith's help, leaving Fromm saddened but relieved. A week before that, the newspaper, Vossische Zeitung, Auntie Voss, where she had worked for years, had closed. She felt more and more that an epoch in which she once had thrived was coming to an end. She said to Hanfstengel, "Of course, if you're going to do away with right and wrong and make it Aryan and non-Aryan, it leaves people who happen to have rather old-fashioned notions about what is right and wrong, what is decent and what is obscene, without much ground to stand on." She turned the conversation back to the subject of Messersmith, whom she described as being so revered by his colleagues that he is practically regarded as having ambassadorial rank, a remark that would have irritated Dodd no end. Hanfstengel softened his voice. "All right, all right," he said. "I have lots of friends in the United States, and all of them side with the Jews, too." But since it is insisted on in the party program, he stopped there in a kind of verbal shrug. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a small bag of candy fruit drops. Lutsch bonbons. Bella had loved them as a child. "Have one," Hanfstengel said. "They are made especially for the Führer." She chose one. Just before she popped it into her mouth, she saw that it was embossed with a swastika. Even fruit drops had been coordinated. The conversation turned to the political warfare that was causing so much unease. Hanfstengel told her that Rome coveted control not only of the German army, but also of Göring's air force. "Hermann's in a rage," Hanfstengel said. "You can do anything to him except fool around with his Luftwaffe. And he could murder Rome in cold blood," he asked. "Do you know Himmler?" Fromm nodded. Hanfstengel said, "He was a chicken farmer when he wasn't on duty spying for the Reichswehr. He kicked Dils out of the Gestapo. Himmler can't stand anybody but Rome least of all. Now they're all ganged up against Rome, Rosenberg, Goebbels, and the chicken farmer." The Rosenberg he mentioned was Alfred Rosenberg, an ardent anti-Semite and head of the Nazi Party's Foreign Bureau. After recounting the conversation in her diary, Fromm added, "There is nobody among the officials of the National Socialist Party who would not cheerfully cut the throat of every other official in order to further his own advancement." It was a measure of the strange new climate of Berlin that another dinner party, wholly innocuous, should prove to have profoundly lethal consequences. The host was a wealthy banker named Wilhelm Rigendanz, a friend of the Dodds, though happily the Dodds were not invited on this particular occasion. Rigendanz held the dinner one evening in May at his luxurious villa in Dahlem, in the southwestern portion of Greater Berlin, known for its lovely homes and its proximity to the Grunewald. Rigendanz, father of seven, was a member of the Stahlhelm, or Steel Helmets, an organization of former army officers with a conservative bent. He liked bringing together men of diverse position for meals, discussions, and lectures. To this particular dinner, Rigendanz invited two prominent guests, French Ambassador François Poncet and Captain Rome, both of whom had been to the house on past occasions. Rome arrived, accompanied by three young SA officers, among them a curly-headed blonde male adjutant nicknamed Count Pretty, who was Rome's secretary, and, rumor held, his occasional lover. Hitler would later describe this meeting as a secret dinner, though in fact the guests made no attempt to disguise their presence. They parked their cars in front of the house in full view of the street, with their tell-all license plates fully exposed. The guests were an odd match. François Poncet disliked the SA chief, as he made clear in his memoir, The Fateful Years. Having always entertained the liveliest repugnance toward Rome, he wrote, "I avoided him as much as possible, despite the eminent role he played in the Third Reich." But Rigendanz had begged François Poncet to come. Later, in a letter to the Gestapo, Rigendanz tried to explain his insistence on getting the two men together. He laid the impetus for the dinner on François Poncet, who, he claimed, had expressed frustration at not being able to meet with Hitler himself, and had asked Rigendanz to speak with someone close to Hitler to communicate his desire for a meeting. Rigendanz suggested that Rome might prove a worthy intermediary. At the time of the dinner, Rigendanz claimed he was unaware of the rift between Rome and Hitler. On the contrary, he told the Gestapo, it was assumed that Rome was the man who absolutely had the confidence of the Führer and was his follower. In other words, one believed that one was informing the Führer when one informed Rome. For dinner, the men were joined by Mrs. Rigendanz and a son, Alex, who was preparing to become an international lawyer. After the meal, Rome and the French ambassador retired to Rigendanz's library for an informal conversation. Rome talked of military matters and disclaimed any interest in politics, declaring that he saw himself only as a soldier, an officer. The result of this conversation, Rigendanz told the Gestapo, was literally nothing. The evening came to an end, mercifully in François Poncet's opinion. The meal was dismal, the conversation insignificant, he recalled. I found Rome sleepy and heavy. He woke up only to complain of his health and the rheumatism he expected to nurse at Vici, a reference to Bad Vici, where Rome planned a lakeside sojourn to take a cure. Returning home, François Poncet wrote, I cursed our host for the evening's boredom. How the Gestapo learned of the dinner and its guests isn't known, But by this point Rome was most certainly under close surveillance. The license plates of the cars parked at Rigondeaux's house would have tipped any watcher off to the identities of the men within. The dinner became infamous. Later in midsummer, Britain's ambassador Phipps would observe in his diary that of the 7 people who sat down to dine at the Rigondeaux mansion that night, 4 had been murdered, 1 had fled the country under threat of death, and another had been imprisoned in a concentration camp. Phipps wrote, "The list of casualties for one dinner party might make even a Borgia envious." And there was this. On Thursday, May 24th, Dodd walked to a luncheon with a senior official of the Foreign Ministry, Hans Heinrich Dickhoff, whom Dodd described as being what amounts to Assistant Secretary of State. They met at a small, discreet restaurant on Unter den Linden, the wide boulevard that ran due east from the Brandenburg Gate, and there they engaged in a conversation that Dodd found extraordinary. Dodd's main reason for wanting to see Dickhoff was to express his dismay at having been made to seem naive by Goebbels's Jews as Syphilis speech, after all he had done to quiet Jewish protests in America. He reminded Dickhoff of the Reich's announced intent to close the Columbia House prison and to require warrants for all arrests, and of other assurances that Germany was easing up on the Jewish atrocities. Dickhoff was sympathetic. He confessed to his own dim view of Goebbels and told Dodd he expected that soon Hitler would be overthrown. Dodd wrote in his diary that Dickhoff gave what he considered good evidence that the Germans would not much longer endure the system under which they were drilled everlastingly and semi-starved. Such candor amazed Dodd. Dickhoff spoke as freely as if he were in England or the United States, Dodd noted, even to the point of expressing the hope that Jewish protests in America would continue. Without them, Dickhoff said, the chances of overthrowing Hitler would diminish. Dodd knew that even for a man of Dickhoff's rank such talk was dangerous. He wrote, "I felt the deep concern of a high official who could thus risk his life in criticism of the existing regime." After exiting the restaurant, the two men walked west along Unter den Linden toward Wilhelmstrasse, the main government thoroughfare. They parted, Dodd wrote, rather sadly. Dodd returned to his office, worked a couple of hours, then took a long walk around the Tiergarten. Chapter 40 A Writer's Retreat. The increasing evidence of social and political oppression came more and more to trouble Martha, in spite of her enthusiasm for the bright, blonde young men whom Hitler attracted by the thousands. One of the most important moments in her education came in May, when a friend, Heinrich Maria Ledig-Rowoldt, a regular in the salon of Mildred and Arvid Harnack, invited her and Mildred to accompany him for a visit to one of the few prominent authors who had not joined the great flight of artistic talent from Nazi Germany. An exodus that included Fritz Lang, Marlene Dietrich, Walter Gropius, Thomas and Heinrich Mann, Bertolt Brecht, Albert Einstein, and composer Otto Klemperer, whose son, actor Werner Klemperer, would go on to portray a kindly, befuddled Nazi prison camp commandant in the TV series Hogan's Heroes. Ledig-Rowoldt was the illegitimate son of publisher Ernst Rowoldt and worked as an editor in his father's company. The author in question was Rudolf Ditzen, known universally by his pseudonym Hans Falada. The visit was supposed to take place earlier in the year, but Falada had postponed it until May because of his anxiety over the publication of his latest book, Once a Jailbird. By this point, Falada had achieved considerable fame worldwide for his novel Little Man, What Now?, about one couple's struggle during the economic and social upheaval of the Weimar Republic. What made Once a Jailbird a subject of such anxiety for Falada was the fact that it was his first major work to be published since Hitler had become chancellor. He was uncertain of his standing in the eyes of Goebbels's Reich Literary Chamber, which claimed the right to decide what constituted acceptable literature. To try to smooth the way for his new book, Falada included in its introduction a statement that praised the Nazis for ensuring that the awful situation at the center of the book could no longer occur. Even his publisher, Rowohlt, thought Falada had gone too far and told him the introduction does seem rather too ingratiating. Falada kept it. In the months following Hitler's ascension to Chancellor, the German writers who were not outright Nazis had quickly divided into two camps. Those who believed it was immoral to remain in Germany, and those who felt the best strategy was to stay put, recede as much as possible from the world, and wait for the collapse of the Hitler regime. The latter approach became known as inner emigration, and was the path Falada had chosen. Martha asked Boris to come along as well. He agreed, despite his previously stated view, that Mildred was someone Martha should avoid. They set out on the morning of Sunday, May 27th, for the three-hour drive to Falada's farmhouse in Karwitz, in the lake country of Mecklenburg, north of Berlin. Boris drove his Ford and, of course, left the top down. The morning was cool and soft, the roads mostly free of traffic. Once outside the city, Boris accelerated. The Ford sped along country roads lined with chestnut and acacia, the air fragrant with spring. Halfway through the drive, the landscape darkened. Little sharp lines of lightning lit up the sky, Martha recalled, and the scene was wild and violent with color, intense electric green and violet, lavender and gray. A sudden rain sent pellets of water exploding against the windscreen, but even here, to the delight of all, Boris kept the top down. The car raced along on a cloud of spray. Abruptly the sky cleared, leaving sun-shafted steam and sudden color, as if they were driving through a painting. The scent of newly moist ground filled the air. As they neared Karwitz, they entered a terrain of hills, meadows, and bright blue lakes laced together with sandy paths. The houses and barns were simple boxes with steeply pitched roofs. They were only 3 hours from Berlin, yet the place seemed remote and hidden. Boris brought the Ford to a stop at an old farmhouse beside a lake. The house stood at the base of a tongue of land called the Bohnenwerder that jutted into the lake and was mounded with hills. Falada emerged from the house, trailed by a young boy of about 4 and Falada's blonde and buxom wife, who held their second child, a baby. A dog bounded out as well. Falada was a boxy man with a square head, wide mouth, and cheekbones so round and hard they might have been golf balls implanted under his skin. His glasses had dark frames and circular lenses. He and his wife gave the new arrivals a brief tour of the farm, which they had bought using the proceeds from Little Man. Martha was struck by the apparent contentment of both. It was Mildred who brought to the fore the questions that had been in the air since the group's arrival, though she was careful to shade them with nuance. As she and Falada strolled to the lake, according to a detailed account by one of Falada's biographers, she talked about her life in America and how she used to enjoy walking along the shore of Lake Michigan. Falada said, "It must be difficult for you to live in a foreign country, especially when your interest is literature and language." "True," she told him, "but it can also be difficult to live in one's own country when one's concern is literature." Falada lit a cigarette. Speaking now very slowly, Falada said, "I could never write in another language, nor live in any other place than Germany." Mildred countered, "Perhaps, Herr Ditzen, it is less important where one lives than how one lives." Falada said nothing. After a moment, Mildred asked, "Can one write what one wishes here these days?" "That depends on one's point of view," he said. "There were difficulties and demands, words to be avoided, but in the end language endured," he said. "Yes, I believe one can still write here in these times, if one observes the necessary regulations and gives in a little. Not in the important things, of course." Mildred asked, "What is important, and what unimportant?" There was lunch and coffee. Martha and Mildred walked to the top of the Bohnenwerder to admire the view. A soft haze muted edges and colors and created an overall sense of peace. Down below, however, Falada's mood had turned stormy. He and Ledig Rovolt played chess. The subject of Falada's introduction to Jailbird came up, and Ledig Rovolt questioned its necessity. He told Falada it had been a topic of conversation during the drive to Karvitz. Upon hearing this, Falada grew angry. He resented being the subject of gossip, and disputed whether anyone had a right to judge him, least of all a couple of American women. When Martha and Mildred returned, the conversation continued, and Mildred joined in. Martha listened as best she could, but her German was not yet expert enough to allow her to pick up enough detail to make sense of it. She could tell, however, that Mildred was gently probing Falada's retreat from the world. His unhappiness at being thus challenged was obvious. Later, Falada walked them through his house. It had 7 rooms, electric light, a spacious attic, and various warming stoves. He showed them his library with its many foreign editions of his own books, and then led them to the room in which his infant son now was napping. Martha wrote, "He revealed uneasiness and self-consciousness, though he tried to be proud and happy in the infant, in his self-tilled garden, in his simple, buxom wife, in the many translations and editions of his books lining the shelves. But he was an unhappy man." Falada took photographs of the group. Boris did likewise. During the journey back to Berlin, the 4 companions again talked about Falada. Mildred described him as cowardly and weak, but then added, "He has a conscience, and that is good. He is not happy. He is not a Nazi. He is not hopeless." Martha recorded another impression. "I saw the stamp of naked fear on a writer's face for the first time." Falada became ultimately a controversial figure in German literature, reviled in some quarters for his failure to stand up to the Nazis, but defended in others for not choosing the safer path of exile. In the years that followed Martha's visit, Falada found himself increasingly compelled to bend his writing to the demands of the Nazi state. He turned to preparing translations for Rovolt, among them Clarence Day's Life with Father, then very popular in the United States, and to writing innocuous works that he hoped would not offend Nazi sensibilities, among them a collection of children's stories about a child's pull toy, Hoppelpoppel, Wo bist du? Hoppelpoppel, Where Are You? He found his career briefly invigorated with publication in 1937 of a novel entitled Wolf Among Wolves, which party officials interpreted as a worthy attack on the old Weimar world, and which Goebbels himself described as a super book. Even so, Falada made more and more concessions, eventually allowing Goebbels to script the ending of his next novel, Iron Gustav, which depicted the hardships of life during the past World War. Falada saw this as a prudent concession. "I do not like grand gestures," he wrote, "being slaughtered before the tyrant's throne senselessly to the benefit of no one and to the detriment of my children. That is not my way." He recognized, however, that his various capitulations took a toll on his writing. He wrote to his mother that he was not satisfied with his work. "I cannot act as I want to, if I want to stay alive. And so a fool gives less than he has." Other writers in exile watched with disdain as Falada and his fellow inner emigrants surrendered to government tastes and demands. Thomas Mann, who lived abroad throughout the Hitler years, later wrote their epitaph. "It may be superstitious belief, but in my eyes, any books which could be printed at all in Germany between 1933 and 1945 are worse than worthless, and not objects one wishes to touch. A stench of blood and shame attaches to them. They should all be pulped." The fear and oppression that Martha saw in Falada crowned a rising mountain of evidence that throughout the spring had begun to erode her infatuation with the new Germany. Her blind endorsement of Hitler's regime first faded to a kind of sympathetic skepticism, but as summer approached, she felt a deepening revulsion. Where once she had been able to wave away the beating incident in Nuremberg as an isolated episode, now she recognized that German persecution of Jews was a national pastime. She found herself repulsed by the constant thunder of Nazi propaganda that portrayed Jews as enemies of the state. Now, when she listened to the anti-Nazi talk of Mildred and Arvid Harnack and their friends, she no longer felt quite so inclined to defend the strange beings of the fledgling revolution whom she had once found so entrancing. By the spring of 1934, she wrote, "What I had heard, seen, and felt revealed to me that conditions of living were worse than in pre-Hitler days, that the most complicated and heartbreaking system of terror ruled the country and repressed the freedom and happiness of the people, and that German leaders were inevitably leading these docile and kindly masses into another war against their will and their knowledge." She was not yet willing, however, to openly declare her new attitude to the world. "I still attempted to keep my hostility guarded and unexpressed." Instead, she revealed it obliquely by proclaiming in deliberately contrarian fashion a new and energetic interest in the Hitler regime's greatest enemy, the Soviet Union. She wrote, "A curiosity began to grow in me as to the nature of this government, so loathed in Germany, and its people, described as so utterly ruthless." Against her parents' wishes, but with Boris's encouragement, she began planning a journey to the Soviet Union. By June, Dodd had come to see that the Jewish problem, as he continued to call it, was anything but improved. Now he told Secretary Hull in a letter, "The prospect of a cessation appears far less hopeful." Like Messerschmitt, he saw that persecution was pervasive, even if it had changed character to become more subtle and less advertised. In May, he reported the Nazi Party had launched a campaign against grumblers and fault-finders that was meant to re-energize Gleichschaltung. Inevitably, it also increased pressure on Jews. Goebbels's newspaper, Der Angriff, began urging readers to keep a sharp eye on the Jews and report any of their shortcomings, Dodd wrote. The Jewish owners of the Frankfurter Zeitung had been forced to abandon their controlling interest, as had the last Jewish owners of the famed Ullstein publishing empire. A large rubber company was told it must provide proof that it had no Jewish employees before it could submit bids to municipalities. The German Red Cross was suddenly required to certify that new contributors were of Aryan origin, and two judges in two different cities granted permission to two men to divorce their wives for the sole reason that the women were Jewish, reasoning that such marriages would yield mixed offspring that would only weaken the German race. Dodd wrote, "These instances and others of lesser importance reveal a different method in the treatment of the Jews, a method perhaps less calculated to bring repercussions from abroad, but reflecting nonetheless the Nazis' determination to force the Jews out of the country." Germany's Aryan population also experienced a new tightening of control. In another dispatch, written the same day, Dodd described how the Ministry of Education had announced that the school week would be divided in such a way that Saturdays and Wednesday evenings would be devoted to the demands of the Hitler Youth. Henceforth, Saturday was to be called Staatsjugendtag, the state's day for youth. The weather remained warm, with scant rain. On Saturday, June 2, 1934, with temperatures in the 80s, Ambassador Dodd wrote in his diary, "Germany looks dry for the first time. Trees and fields are yellow. The papers are full of accounts of the drought in Bavaria and in the United States as well." In Washington, Moffett also took note of the weather. In his diary, he called it the Great Heat, and cited Sunday, May 20th, as the day it had begun, with a high of 93 degrees, in his office. No one knew it yet, of course, but America had entered the second of a series of cataclysmic droughts that would soon transform the Great Plains into the Dust Bowl. Chapter 41. Trouble at the Neighbors. As summer neared, the sense of unease in Berlin became acute. The mood was tense and electric, Martha wrote. Everyone felt there was something in the air, but did not know what it was. The strange atmosphere and the fragile condition of Germany were topics of conversation at a late afternoon tea-empfang, a tea party hosted by Putzi Hanfstengel on Friday, June 8, 1934, which the Dodd family attended. On their way home from the tea, the Dodds could not help but notice that something unusual was happening in Bendlerstrasse, the last side street they passed before reaching their house. There, in easy view, stood the buildings of the Bendler Block, Army headquarters. Indeed, the Dodds and the Army were almost back-fence neighbors. A man with a strong arm could throw a stone from the family's yard and expect to break one of the Army's windows. The change was obvious. Soldiers stood on the roofs of headquarters buildings. Heavily armed patrols moved along the sidewalks. Army trucks and Gestapo cars clogged the street. These forces remained throughout Friday night and Saturday. Then Sunday morning, June 10th, the troops and trucks were gone. At the Dodds house, a coolness spread outward from the forested ground of the Tiergarten. There were riders in the park, as always, and the thud of hooves was audible in the Sunday morning quiet. Chapter 42 Herman's Toys. Amid the many rumors of coming upheaval, it remained difficult for Dodd and his peers in the diplomatic corps to imagine that Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels could endure much longer. Dodd still saw them as inept and dangerous adolescents, 16-year-olds, as he now put it, who found themselves confronting an accumulation of daunting troubles. The drought grew steadily more severe. The economy showed little sign of improvement, other than the illusory decline in unemployment. The rift between Rome and Hitler seemed to have deepened, and there continued to be moments, strange, ludicrous moments, that suggested that Germany was merely the stage set for some grotesque comedy, not a serious country in a serious time. Sunday, June 10, 1934, provided one such episode, when Dodd, French Ambassador François Poncet, and Britain's Sir Eric Phipps, along with three dozen other guests, attended a kind of open house at Goering's vast estate, an hour's drive north of Berlin. He had named it Karin Hall for his dead Swedish wife, Karin, whom he revered. Later in the month, he planned to exhume her body from its resting place in Sweden, transport it to Germany, and entomb it in a mausoleum on the estate grounds. Today, however, Goering wanted merely to show off his forests and his new bison enclosure, where he hoped to breed the creatures and then turn them loose on his grounds. The Dodds arrived late in their new Buick, which had betrayed them along the way with a minor mechanical failure, but they still managed to arrive before Goering himself. Their instructions called for them to drive to a particular point on the estate. To keep guests from getting lost, Goering had stationed men at each crossroads to provide directions. Dodd and his wife found the other guests gathered around a speaker who held forth on some aspect of the grounds. The Dodds learned they were at the edge of the bison enclosure. At last Goering arrived, driving fast, alone, in what Phipps described as a racing car. He climbed out wearing a uniform that was partly the costume of an aviator, partly that of a medieval hunter. He wore boots of India rubber, and in his belt had tucked a very large hunting knife. Goering took the place of the first speaker. He used a microphone, but spoke loudly into it, producing a jarring effect in the otherwise sylvan locale. He described his plan to create a forest preserve that would reproduce the conditions of primeval Germany, complete with primeval animals like the bison, that now stood indolently in the near distance. Three photographers and a cinematograph operator captured the affair on film. Elisabetta Cerruti, the beautiful Hungarian and Jewish wife of the Italian ambassador, recalled what happened next. "Ladies and gentlemen," Goering said, "in a few minutes you will witness a unique display of nature at work." He gestured toward an iron cage. "In this cage is a powerful male bison, an animal almost unheard of on the continent. He will meet here before your very eyes the female of his species. Please be quiet, and don't be afraid." Goering's keepers opened the cage. "Ivan the Terrible," Goering commanded, "I order you to leave the cage." The bull did not move. Goering repeated his command. Once again, the bull ignored him. The keepers now attempted to prod Ivan into action. The photographers readied themselves for the lustful charge certain to ensue. Britain's Ambassador Phipps wrote in his diary that the bull emerged from the cage with the utmost reluctance, and after eyeing the cows somewhat sadly tried to return to it. Phipps also described the affair in a later memorandum to London that became famous within the British Foreign Office as the Bison Dispatch. Next, Dodd and Matty and the other guests climbed aboard 30 small two-passenger carriages driven by peasants and set off on a long meandering ride through forests and across meadows. Goering was in the lead in a carriage pulled by two great horses, with Mrs. Cheruti seated to his right. An hour later, the procession halted near a swamp. Goering climbed from his carriage and gave another speech, this on the glories of birds. Once again, the guests climbed into their carriages, and after another lengthy ride came to a glade where their cars stood waiting. Goering levered his massive self into his car and raced off at high speed. The other guests followed at a slower pace, and after 20 minutes came to a lake beside which stood an immense newly constructed lodge that seemed meant to evoke the home of a medieval lord. Goering was waiting for them, dressed in a wholly new outfit, a wonderful new white summer garb, Dodd wrote, white tennis shoes, white duck trousers, white shirt, and a hunting jacket of green leather, in whose belt the same hunting knife appeared. In one hand he held a long implement that seemed a cross between a shepherd's staff and a harpoon. It was now about 6 o'clock, and the afternoon sun had turned the landscape a pleasing amber. Staff in hand, Goering led his guests into the house. A collection of swords hung just inside the main door. He showed off his gold and silver rooms, his card room, library, gym, and movie theater. One hallway was barbed with dozens of sets of antlers. In the main sitting room they found a live tree, a bronze image of Hitler, and an as-yet unoccupied space in which Goering planned to install a statue of Woden, the Teutonic god of war. Goering displayed his vanity at every turn, Dodd observed. He noted that a number of guests traded amused but discreet glances. Then Goering drew the party outside, where all were directed to sit at tables set in the open air for a meal orchestrated by the actress Emmy Sonnemann, whom Goering identified as his private secretary, though it was common knowledge that she and Goering were romantically involved. Mrs. Dodd liked Sonnemann, and in coming months would become, as Martha noted, rather attached to her. Ambassador Dodd found himself seated at a table with Vice-Chancellor Papen, Phipps, and François Poncet, among others. He was disappointed in the result. The conversation had no value, he wrote, though he found himself briefly engaged when the discussion turned to a new book about the German Navy in World War I, during which far too enthusiastic talk of war led Dodd to say, "If people knew the truth of history, there would never be another great war." Phipps and François Poncet laughed uncomfortably. Then came silence. A few moments later, talk resumed. We turned, Dodd wrote, to other and less risky subjects. Dodd and Phipps assumed, hoped, that once the meal was over they would be able to excuse themselves and begin their journey back to Berlin, where both had an evening function to attend. But Goering now informed all that the climax of the outing, this strange comedy, Phipps called it, was yet to come. Goering led his guests to another portion of the lakeshore some 500 yards away, where he stopped before a tomb erected at the water's edge. Here Dodd found what he termed the most elaborate structure of its kind I ever saw. The mausoleum was centered between two great oaks and 6 large sarsen stones, reminiscent of those at Stonehenge. Goering walked to one of the oaks and planted himself before it, legs apart, like some gargantuan wood sprite. The hunting knife was still in his belt, and again he wielded his medieval staff. He held forth on the virtues of his dead wife, the idyllic setting of her tomb, and his plans for her exhumation and reinterment, which was to occur 10 days hence on the summer solstice, a day that the pagan ideology of the National Socialists had freighted with symbolic importance. Hitler was to attend, as were legions of men from the army, SS,